We're going to get started again, folks, and questions from the audience. I think I just want to start with the question that I asked earlier in the car, which has to do with, I don't know, just the significance to you of the title Anima, since we focused on that work today.
Why don't you ask the critics?
Pardon?
Why don't you ask the critics? I don't know. No, anima in Spanish has certain levels. One is very literal. It simply means spirit. So anything that as poetry has a spiritual connotation can be directed towards that word. It has also this double consideration where you have the anima and the animus and the Jungian conception. We have the feminine and the masculine, the esposo and the esposa in the mystic, at least Spanish tradition. And I think all those concepts, and especially the literal idea, must have been circling in my head. And it was sort of natural. It was a moment in which calling the first poem Anima, and then seeing that I did a second poem similar to the first one, and a third, and a fourth. And it's a book that, at one point, I began to detest, literally, using the place where I live now, where I've been living for 14 years, which is called Hallandale. And I said to myself, it's a horrible place. Why am I immortalizing Hallandale? It's horrible, middle class, totally unintellectual, unpoetical place. And I started thinking, maybe instead of Hallandale, I'll do a second edition of this book and get rid of Hallandale. But then, in Cuba, a lot of my friends and people that read me and all that began to be very attracted to Hallandale. And I published in Mexico five letters called Cartas de Hallandale. So I had set up a situation where Hallandale was already being mystified, you know? And I decided to leave it. And at this point, the whole issue of anima also implies that I began to work in series, as a painter does. I've never been influenced by poets. Poets are, to me, detestable human beings. I don't want to deal with them. They're spoilers, they're destroyers. Pound talks about that, you know, the destroyers. Whereas composers, painters, musicians, have always influenced me. I've learned from them. I was very friendly with Philip Guston at one point in Woodstock. You know, I was a bartender for 3 months, and one of my customers was Bob Dylan. For 3 months, I got him drunk.
In Woodstock.
And Joan Baez, who was exquisite physically. And I started doing this series. You know, this anima thing was the beginning of a number of series. By now, I have about 50 different series. One is called Divertimento, another one is called Acta, another one is called Pareja Inmortal, Anima, many of them, you know. And the reason for the series, I've conceptualized it, that book of mine that you just purchased, mm-hmm. that has the interview, I explain in there why the series. And it's the sense that one works always, as a poet, as any form of creator, in an incomplete fashion. You keep on writing the same poem endlessly to see if ever you'll be able to write a poem, the poem, what Mallarmé dreamt of and what we all dream of, the absolute poem that cannot exist. So the idea of the series is that, but in my case it began for a different reason. I can write you a poem such as the ones you heard tonight literally in 20 minutes. I have no difficulty with the act of writing poetry. It's a very strange thing because I never plan a poem. I've never thought beforehand about writing a given poem using a theme or using, you know, I'm going to dedicate a poem to Steve Dickinson, God forbid. You know, no, none of that, none of that. However, I sit down and a word comes in. I believe that that has a reason, and for a reason it has happened, and I begin to write, and I write, and I write, and I write, and then, and that's it, it's finished. It's 20, 25 minutes, 30 minutes. The last poem I read must have been written in 40 minutes. It's a very long poem, very complex poem. And then I correct the poem very carefully next day. That's a different story. So I have no difficulty with the act of writing. You know what the difficulty is? Titles. They drive me absolutely crazy. That's the only area in poetry where I suffer. I have to give a title. In the beginning, I'd never titled the poems. I never gave titles to them until the following happened. I would send poems to a magazine, an editor. They would ask me whatever. And they take three poems that had no titles, and they put it together as one poem, which many times made the poem better than the three separate poems. You know? Seriously. So at that point, I said, well, I have to solve this problem. And when Anima comes up, was maybe the third of a number of a series. I said, all I have to do now is do a poem and stick it into the series. And I've been doing that for years and years and years. I have about 50 series. So I write first the poem, and then I kind of look at the map of all my series, and I say, this one fits in there perfectly. Bah, bah, bah. No title. Did I answer your question?
You did. Absolutely.
Is this on? Okay, cool. About your grandfather and what your grandfather said, cautioned you about becoming
a lawyer.
And said, because, you know, they have to lie.
I studied law in Cuba for 2 years, by the way, against his advice. And then I left.
That's interesting. Yeah. Okay, but you became a poet. So don't you think that a poet's relationship to truth is also possibly
a little questionable? Well, we're the biggest liars on earth. I mean, all we do is lie. I mean, I was listening to the English translations that you people read, and I was laughing inside of me because the references that appear, I know where they come from, and you do not. And they're, you know, have that control. And I can see that in the poem something is being stated as if, you know, reality. This is the poet says it. It's total fantasy, it's total lies, it's not that way. It didn't happen that way. It's not that, you know. So that, of course, the relationship between poetry and reality is the same relationship that exists between any form of art and reality. I'm doing a series which is called De lo Real a lo Pintado, which is a Baroque, golden century form of dealing. Sor Juan Inés de la Cruz did this, of dealing with reality, which is the difference between that which is painted and that which is real, as when Sor Juana is painted at the court in Mexico and she sees herself in that painting and she knows that that is not Sor Juana, that is not her. Or maybe it is. And, you know, the dialectics between the painting and who you think you are begin to operate. So that, I mean, poetry has nothing to do with truth or the madness of lying, but it's something else. And the more I have lived in the act of writing poems, the more I feel, A, that I know nothing about poetry, but B, that I don't want to know anything about poetry. Rather, just write. And I write. I simply write. It happens. It's been happening every day for now a number of years. I told you in the interview, but I may repeat it now, that I've always been very prolific since early childhood. In Cuba, I began writing at age maybe 16, and I noticed that I just wrote crap. You know what a child age 16 would write, but I wrote. I left Cuba, and I lost my language. I lost Spanish. I couldn't speak Spanish for 10 years. There was no Spanish in my life. This is New York, 1960. There were no Spanish in the streets. There were no immigrants in New York at that time. There were Puerto Ricans and the first few Cubans that were coming to New York. And I had no access to books in Spanish. I married an American. All my friends were Americans. I had to learn English to eat, to survive. And Spanish started deteriorating, to the point that 10 years after, I realized, A, it's been 10 years that I don't write, and B, I don't write because I have no longer a language, which is my own language. And I was also drinking a lot. I was very wild, you know, marijuana and all those things. It's the 1960s, you know, long hair, pimples, you know, the works. And at that point, something happened, and I went back into Spanish. Then I married Guadalupe, we had a house in Spain, and I got into the teaching profession in Spanish. So, you know, my whole life went back into Spanish, and I started, literally, it was a resuscitation of my own native language. And I began to reorder my inner self, not in English, but in Spanish. And the writing began to flow very naturally, very consistently. But always prolific, always prolific. When I recover Spanish, I remember writing at times 30, 40 short poems in 3-4 hours, while drinking, of course. You cannot write 30 poems unless you're absolutely drunk. And I was drunk most of the day. But something then happened which made me even more prolific, and this I cannot, in all honesty, understand, which is this. I had not been back to Cuba in 42 years. And I have an attachment for Cuba that is very complex, very neurotic, very deep. It's a very complex form of love, and it's basically a love for that island, a love for that lousy country, and partially a love for a country that accepted my parents, Jews, escaping from a Europe that was totally anti-Semitic, had no place to go, and they found in Cuba a home, a house. My father, who was a Polish Jew with a terrible Jewish accent when he spoke Spanish when he left, when he went into exile in 61, he died. He died. He literally died. He had no life. And he always used to mumble, "I cannot live in any other place but Cuba." And you know, he would say that with a Jewish accent. "Es que yo no puedo vivir en otro país sino Cuba." He would talk like that. And, you know, one thing is his accent, and one thing is the meaning of what he's conveying. And so I went back to Cuba in 2002. Guadalupe and I, we had a very complex invitation from the Cuban government because they published an anthology of my poetry down there, and I was the first Cuban poet in exile that they had accepted to be published. After literal years of persecution of our work for political reasons and none other, in the 70s, in the 80s, I was a persona non grata in Cuba. You know, I've been nominated now for 3 years to the National Literature Prize in Cuba, and it's not given to me and will never be given to me because there's a law that says that it cannot be given to Cubans outside of Cuba, who live outside of Cuba. That's how absurd the whole, you know, political issue can become. So we went back to Cuba with this invitation to present this book. I made a deal with the government, which was I will do a so-called official reading in Cuba, and then I will do a second reading in a place where all the people that are against you read. And they accepted it. So I did a reading at the book fair. France was an invited country that year, which was official. And then I did a reading at what is called La Azotea de Reina, a Cuban poet by the name of Reina Maria Rodriguez, who has an azotea, rooftop, where poets meet, young poets usually, and they do their own thing. They read their poems, you know? And I did that reading. It was a very complex week in my life, extremely complex. And, you know, I saw the house, this Estrada Palma 515, the poem you read, which is my house, which is still my house. I went to the synagogue where my grandfather and I did my bar mitzvah. You know, very painful. It was very Proustian also. I would recognize in my house, we went into the bathroom and there was a toothbrush. And I looked at Guadalupe and I said, "You see this toothbrush?" She said, "Yeah, yeah." I said, "It's my toothbrush. They're still using it." Which was a joke, of course, but in a sense it was not. It was not. And we arrived on the 7th of February 2002. We left on the 14th, 7 days after. On the 7th, I wrote a poem. On the 8th, I wrote a poem. On the 9th, on the 10th, on the 11th. So I wrote 7 poems during those 7 days. We were in Hallandale already, Wilder? Yeah, back to Hallandale. And I wrote a poem. And it's been since the 7th of February 2002 to this morning in this hotel, here in San Francisco that I have written every single day without failure, a poem. A poem. A poem of this nature, of this type. These are not little Japanese haikus. Why, how, it puzzles me. I don't want to write, I don't need to write, I don't depend in any way anymore on this, but I write, and I write, and I write a poem every day. I hope tomorrow I do not. I think tomorrow I will. No, I'm talking to myself. I see it happening all the time. I don't understand it. I had an accident in Buenos Aires, I was telling in the interview, where I fell in the streets, and I had one of those, it's called a subdural hematoma, like Mrs. Clinton had later on. And all I know is that I was teaching in Buenos Aires, and I needed the money. So I stayed 4 weeks teaching, and when I came to Miami, I went to my doctor, and he said, there's something wrong with you. He sent me to a neurologist, and he said, let's do an MRI. They did the MRI. Half of my brain was constricted. I had been bleeding slowly all these weeks. So he said, go to Dr. So-and-so, you need an operation. So we Cubans, we can convince anyone of anything. We can convince a lizard that the lizard is a stone. We can convince a stone that the stone is a lizard. We have that capacity. And I convinced this neurologist to wait a while before the operation. And then he said to me, months after, it's never happened to me, that was a mistake. It could have cost you your life. So he did a second MRI, and the situation was similar. So he said, go to the doctor. I went to the doctor, he looked at the MRI, he said, you're going into the operation room right now. And I started talking, he said, no, he's Dominican, and they're like us, Cubans, you know? So he said, no, you're going to the operation room right now. All I remember is they opened up a hole in there, and when I came back, my oldest daughter and Guadalupe were talking to the doctor, and I listened to the conversation, and the doctor saying to them in Spanish, of course, said, if I don't operate on Jose today, in 2 days, he would have been dead. Now he'll be okay. Okay, so I was in intensive care, and he came 2 hours after, wonderful guy, very nice and very idealistic person, and he said to me, how do you feel? So I said, I feel like shit, you know, how can I feel? So he said, well, you're going to be okay, blah, blah, blah. And joking around, because he's a joker and I am a joker, I said to him, doctor, when you opened me up, did you find any poems in there? So he says, yeah, two. I said, oh, those must have been the two poems I wrote this morning. And I swear to you, this is a true story. I wrote two little poems in intensive care, at the verge of having died, I wrote. So it's been now, from February 7th, 2002, to this morning, we're in 2016, and today is the 10th of November. I've written a poem every day. Possibly I will be punished for this. And the punishment will be as such. He was a lousy poet, a meaningless poet, but he broke the Guinness Book of Records. And that will be my call to glory, my call to fame. Broke the Guinness Book of Records. Okay.
Can you say something about the Neo Barocco? Your relation to Jose Lezama Lima and the Neo Barocco?
Yeah, I have personally no relation to Jose Lezama Lima and the Neo Baroque. You know Enrique Lin, the Chilean poet, you've heard his name? Enrique Lin? Okay. Mm-hmm. Enrique one night slept in our home in Forest Hills in New York, and in the morning we were talking, and he looked at me and he said, Jose, you are somehow being called in Cuba the heredero, the inheritor of Lezama. How do you feel about that? And I said, Enrique, I have nothing to do with Lezama, because I read, and this is true, I read Lezama Lima for the first time in my life when I was about 40 years of age. So, you know, I was already very much into what I do. And in Cuba, they have written a lot about how I am not related to Lezama in terms of an influence. And if I was, I would be honored by this. I have no problem with this issue of, I have no anxiety of influence in any form or sense, you know. So, but no, there's none of that. Lezama was a very complex man, as you probably know, and he was very Baroque. His Barroco was Góngora. Góngora was his mentor, was and not Quevedo, because the Spanish Baroque in the Golden Century has two avenues, the Conceptistas and the Góngoristas. The Góngoristas are basically beauty, the idea of beauty, and the Conceptistas is what the mind is all about. So you have Góngora and Quevedo and their fight and their animosity, which has a lot to do with the fact that Quevedo was a terrible anti-Semite and Góngora was Jewish. There's an anecdote which people don't know, but Góngora was a very poor man, and Quevedo, not that he was rich, but he was part of the establishment. And at the end of Góngora's life, the last year of his life, he had no money even to eat. But he lived in a small house in Córdoba, a shack, literally. And the shack happened to be owned by Quevedo. And when he realized that Quevedo was the owner of the shack, he threw him out. He threw him out. And Góngora was in the streets, literally. Although he then was protected, blah, blah, blah. You know, he survived, he this and that. But it's a terrible situation. What happens with poetry is that in the Hispanic world, the American way, very conversational, very transparent, very, as American poetry is, it's not Baroque, took over through Whitman. Whitman is Neruda. Neruda is, you know, overflowing. So that poetry became very conversational, very transparent, very anecdotical. And this took over. This is the majority of poetry and poems that come through in both Spain and Latin America until the neo-Baroque came in, where I'm the oldest of the group at this point, and an anthology was put together by Echavarren, Sefami, and myself, which is called Medusario. And Medusario is a book that has a history of itself that is very complex, and I have no time to tell you about this. But when Medusario was published, to the surprise of Fondo de Cultura, who thought it won't sell, 3 copies, it sold 2,000 copies in less than 6 months. And everyone was flabbergasted. It changed completely the mode of writing poetry in Spanish in Latin America in the last 20 years. And the newest generations are into this mood, into this type of poetry. Very Brazil is the same issue. The same issue. It's very dense. It's very complex. They've discovered Sukovsky. They've discovered Olson, of course. Olson is a big myth in Latin America right now. And, you know, in small circles, as all poetry is. I'm fighting for Laureen Niedeker to be translated into Spanish and to be known in the Hispanic world because she's totally unknown. And I'm fighting for her, you know? Not easy. No, no. But a poet that has such a complexity in her shortness that I can easily put it in a peripheral vein within the neo-Baroque. You know, but I'm in touch with young poets from different countries where, you know, it's Paul Celan at the end of Paul Celan's work. It's totally déchirant. It's totally broken to pieces. They're angry with language. They're angry with poetry. They're angry with everything, you know. And this explosion comes from Medusario. I gave a reading and a talk in Mexico about 5 years ago where they asked me to clausurar, to close a congress of young poets. And they came from all over Latin America, about 50 poets. And there was a question and answer period. And one of them said, brought up the issue of the neo-Baroque. So I started elaborating the idea. And at one point, I said, what amazes me is that you people, being so young, you read voraciously, you are many times you have no money to eat, but you'll buy a book. And this is a fact, you know. There's a new generation in Latin America, age 20 to 35, let's say, doing such dense, complex things, such daring, risky poetry that is not happening anyplace else that I know of in the world.
What about the language poets?
The language poets would be the closest to it, yet the neo-Baroque, which is language-oriented, obviously, is something else. It's different. Maybe it's what the American language poets are doing, a la española, the Spanish way, or you know, it's a different vein. It's a different.
Well, they had in common Zhukovsky.
Indeed. Although I think Zhukovsky is more real to the language poets and to this country than to us, because you know, A hasn't been translated into Spanish yet. Mm-hmm. Only poems here and there by translators that I personally know. And when I've said, but why don't you translate the entire book? They said, no one wants to fund this, and I cannot spend, you know, translating Zhukovsky is a 10-year, translating A is a 10-year job.
Right.
It's a 10-year job.
Right.
And no payment for this, no nothing for this. I mean, a translator can be angelical or saintly, but not to that degree. You have to eat. No, you have to eat. So. It's not happening. And this is very sad. This is very saddening. It for the time being, it's a loss. But he's known, and a lot of the young people also do read English, and they're beginning to get into... You know, I have this dream where at one point, poetry in English and poetry in Spanish can come together and benefit each other mutually and tremendously. Because what's happening in what has happened in poetry in this country, particularly, and also in England or Ireland, is unbelievable. It's great, and yet we're not very well informed. And you people are not very well informed as to what's happening, especially with the newer generations. Because if you go to Medusario, you have Echavarren, you have Zurita, you have Espina, you have Comensain, you know, you have a number of poets that are now known. But after them, there's this incredible amount of younger people. I mean, in Brazil, in Chile, when I got the Neruda Prize, you know, I met a lot of the young incoming poets. And you sit down with them and you start talking. I've read since I'm 14. I read every day since I retired. I've been reading 6-7 hours a day. So, you know, my life is reading and writing and being at home. That's it. I don't have any other need or desire. And, you know, you talk to those people who are 30 years and they've read as much as I have read. And I say, how is it possible? And they always answer the same way. I say, I don't know. I read. Leave me alone. You know, it's an amazing phenomenon. Maybe it's the uncertainty for them of life, the difficulty of being young today is so different from when I was young. When I was young, life was so easy in many ways, you know? New York was so cheap. I lived in a 5-room apartment on West 4th and 6th Avenue, and I paid $75 a month rent. I used to drink wines in 1964 that today a bottle for which I pay a buck would cost thousands of dollars. And I drank. So, you know, it's maybe all that has created a generation, as it happened in Spain in the golden century. Life was so difficult. There was hunger. Spain was the richest and the poorest country in the universe. And it produced Góngora, Quevedo, San Juan, Santa Teresa, Baltasar del Alcázar. I mean, names that are, each of them, an opus never ending in its Cervantes. What else do you want? Cervantes. So I didn't answer your question, right?
No, sure. That is it. Well, I just want to ask you one more. How about somebody like John Ashbery?
For instance, Echavarren, which is one of the three in Medusario, is a translator of Ashbery. So Ashbery is well known in Latin America. I mean, fairly well known, especially in Mexico. In Mexico, he's known. Now, Ashbery is a different story. Even though he's difficult, he's not as difficult as Zhukovsky, for instance, you know.
Well, he has a laconic mode.
Yeah.
Where it's muted irony.
Right. And he can be very conversational, yeah. And which is also, I do that in my own poetry. I can constantly switch or shifting from very dense referential things to very light and, you know. In the poem that I think Steve read or you read, the one about the mist that happens in Italy. No, you read it? Well, I don't remember. Some words are being used, which is from a song by Frank Sinatra. So it's stuck into the poem, you know, and it's very, people don't realize it. Yeah. Okay. We can go eat.